right. Hello, everyone. Welcome to the first Sunday Assembly of 2015. Yeah. And our first, no, it's our, well, so kind of our first service as a tax-exempt nonprofit. So we tried to broadcast, but we did have our 501c3 status come through. The IRS said, sure, yeah, you guys, we buy it. So that was exciting. Anyways, I've got more announcements that I'll save for later, but just wanted to say welcome. Thank you for coming. So January, we're going to do self-empowerment, self-improvement today. I'm up here now to introduce Dr. Henry Steinberger, who is our speaker today. Dr. Steinberger received his PhD, postdoctoral fellowship from the Albert Ellis Institute in 1991, and he's been here in private practice in Madison, Wisconsin since 1987. He specializes in the treatment of alcohol and other substance abuse disorders, and he's been practicing smart recovery since before the smart recovery program was actually a program. Back in 1991, he started being a meeting facilitator, and since then has actually joined the smart recovery program. That's a national program. In 2004, he edited the second edition of the Smart Recovery Handbook, and now he is our Smart Recovery Facilitator here in the Madison area. So I'll bring Dr. Henry Steinberger. Henry, Dr. Steinberger, whichever you would like to be.
Henry is just fine. And
then here's your clicker.
Oh, my clicker.
Yep, down.
Down is forward. That's me. That's the company, that's the address, just south of Hilldale Shopping Center, long-term advocate and advisor. I don't facilitate. I talk too much to be a good facilitator. But I did insist that we'd call it a facilitator, not a teacher, not a leader, not a convener, because they facilitate, they make things go forward in the meeting. Initially, that was what we were about, but we've added tools and techniques to the program. So I'm an advisor to Smart Recovery. I was on their board of directors for 9 years. I started the group here when it was still called something else, which I won't mention because it only confuses you, then you'll give the wrong name when people ask you about it, so I never mention it. I've had too many professionals mention that other name as if it was us. It went commercial. The guy wanted to franchise it. He's a very nice man, but he wanted a company that would earn him money, and we wanted to be a nonprofit, a 501c3. Yeah, that's us. So,
family?
Oh, God. So I also have been associated with moderation management. I haven't been able to get meetings going in this town, but both groups have online meetings, which I'll discuss more later. And as it's on the program, the purpose of Smart Recovery is to help individuals gain independence from addictive behaviors and lead meaningful and satisfying lives. Just stopping using is not enough. Somebody actually just sent me an article about Rat Park, a study that was done with rats. Thank you very much for it. It reminded me of this brilliant Canadian study. You know, usually when they do those studies about cocaine addiction, they put a rat in a cage with two bottles. One is tainted with cocaine and the other is just water. And the rat has nothing the hell to do and it sits there and all it does is eat, sleep. It's in solitary confinement. What the heck is it gonna do? It has a lot of cocaine. So obviously cocaine is very, very, very addictive. Well, some Canadian scientists set up what he called Rat Park. It had they didn't feed the rats, they hid the food. As the rat had to go out and find it, run through tubes, through mazes, through things that looked like your basement. It had the opportunity to explore. It had the opportunity to have fun. They put the males and the females together, and you know what that does. These were happy rats, and they offered them cocaine or water. Why don't you eat cocaine? I'm having a wonderful time here. Thank you very much. They went over and they tasted that once in a while, but they were recreational users. They were not addicted. So much for addiction being, well, for some people, it's a very, very horrible thing because they have an environment a lot like the rat in the cage with nothing but choice of do you want water or do you want drugs? But let me get back to Smart Recovery since that's what I've been asked to speak about. Mission and vision. Our mission is to offer no fee, we don't like to say free, but I don't mind, free self-help, empowering, science-based, face-to-face, and online support groups for abstaining from any substance or activity. We don't have a smart recovery for alcohol and another one for narcotics and another one for cigarettes and another one for any other thing that you've heard could be an addiction, and I don't always agree that everything is an addiction. And our vision is think smart worldwide, and we have succeeded there too. If you can mention an English-speaking country, we have smart groups there. And we also have the handbook translated into Spanish, Portuguese, German. Well, I'll come to that later. Now, no doubt you've thought about diversity here, about how we try to introduce diversity into education, into the workplace, and everywhere, based on age, based on gender, based on education, based on socioeconomic situation and language and sexual orientation and cultural and traditions. But do we try for diversity, at least amongst those groups that help people with addictions? Do we think about their belief system? Working with Albert Ellis, I already had a suspicion, but I certainly learned that we're not so much bothered, as I think it was Epictetus said, by events, but it's the beliefs we have about those events that upset us. If I think somebody has just stepped on my toe on the bus, and I think that they are stupid, inconsiderate fools to step on my toe, I start to get, well, whatever I get, it ain't a nice emotion. And then I turn around and I see the white cane and, now my beliefs have changed. Same stepping on the foot, but my beliefs are different about why my foot was stepped on. So beliefs are very important, and spiritual, religious, or secular humanistic beliefs, I believe, as an FFRF member, and apparently I'm speaking today to the choir, are very important. It's wonderful talking to the choir. You don't have to explain everything or prove anything. In the area of addictions, for many, many years, the only alternative was something that was started in the 1930s based on something that went way back to the beginning of the century, a religious organization called the Oxford Group that had nothing to do with Oxford University, but thought it would sound better if it had some connection to something that sounded science-based and brilliant. From that background, Bill Wilson brought up, invented AA. How many people here had never heard of AA? Not a one. Our society is drenched with information about AA. But before you came here today, how many people had heard about smart recovery? Not the full house. Okay, well, I'm glad you had me. Thank you, Nomi, for inviting me. So there's a need for a secular option. I mean, personally, my grandmother's second husband was a very devout atheist. Coming from a Jewish background, they would go out every Friday night, the Sabbath, to eat pork, spare ribs, and lobster. They were devoutly atheist. And Jack, we used to say uncle, because that was the respectful way to talk to somebody who was older than you but wasn't really your grandfather. Uncle Jack, it was clear that in the evenings he drank a lot of bourbon and got very belligerent and was a pretty miserable person. But during the day he was a sweetheart. He was Dr. Jekyll to Mr. Hyde. I later figured out that the reason he needed the second bedroom with a lock and key that was all his was because he was a maintenance drinker during the day, and at night he upped the ante. But he had a problem with alcohol. That is, and I don't even like the word alcoholic. That means you're a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. I prefer people first language. He was a person with an alcohol problem, and a pretty severe one at that. It ruined my family. It really upset my mother because she didn't get the second bedroom. She had to sleep on the couch all her life until she was sort of tossed out because she got in the way of his drinking. Sad thing. He couldn't go to AA and ask the God that he didn't believe in to remove his defects of character. He wasn't about to be powerless. So what could he do? he was a brilliant man. He wrote for the United Secularists of America. If you go online and look for was Jesus a myth or is Christianity based on no did Jesus exist or was Christianity based on a myth? He's the author of that wonderful tract under the name Historicus. He did not put out Jack Benjamin. That would have really gotten bricks through the window in Brooklyn even. But he convinced me by his very horrible death from pancreatic cancer that there really is a need for a secular approach. And the research, beyond my personal experience, the research indicates that a secular group will attract and engage people who are low in religiosity. Atheists, agnostics, theists, humanists, Reformed Jews, Reconstructionists, Unitarians, United Methodists, which are the groups that are the most left-leaning, the most liberated from dogma? People who are less inclined towards that high degree of religiosity much prefer a group that shares their worldview. And the research shows that people who are high in religiosity really do benefit from attending and engaging in a group that prays together and begs God to come down and fix it. The high courts of the United States and various states and federal courts have ruled that mandating somebody to a 12-step program violates the Establishment Clause of the U.S. Constitution, our wonderful godless Constitution. So it shouldn't be going on, and if you know of a case where somebody is being forced into 12-step groups against their will because we're not going to let you work or we're not going to let you drive or we're going to take away your rights until you find your higher power, God as you know him, and sober up. So we're just saying you need to sober up. You don't have to have a spiritual awakening. Do most people know about the 12 steps? Does anybody here not realize that it's a religious organization, that the purpose is not really sobriety, though that's a side, that it's the purpose is to have a spiritual awakening, and that will cure everything, and God will come and remove your defects of character. That's the sixth step, if you ask him really nicely. Yeah, question?
I'm raising my hand.
Oh, because you knew that.
I did not.
Oh, you didn't know that. Anybody else didn't know that? Wow. Yeah, you see it on TV, but you never really understand that the first step is I'm powerless, and then you do a moral, nothing wrong with a moral inventory, though I didn't know using drugs was immoral. I thought it was illegal, depending on the drug. And is it illegal to use alcohol? No, the legal ones are the ones that kill more people than anything, alcohol and cigarettes, which is why I always ask people, do you smoke? And we discuss that no matter what the case is. Oh, good, we're being fruitful and multiplying. What? Darn atheists are never going to catch up with them. But you don't have to be like rabbits, the Pope said last week. So I guess we're coming along. You didn't hear that?
No.
We'll discuss that after this. So we actually have, in Smart Recovery, a position paper on spirituality that is, it's written in our website, that we believe that the power to change addictive behaviors resides within each individual and doesn't depend on adherence to any spiritual viewpoint. The use of religious or spiritual beliefs and practices in recovery is a personal choice and not part of our program. Well, the latest thing in psychology, unfortunately, is that mindfulness meditation is really effective, and it has some Buddhist roots, and many people consider meditation to be a spiritual practice. Well, soon Smart Recovery will have to reword this somewhat, because even Sam Harris, in his new book, Waking Up, what is it called? Waking Up, the subtitle is, anybody know? Spirituality Without Religion. There we go. He makes the point that we have to get over our obsession with perfect words. Spirituality does carry a lot of junk with it. But think of a better term for that inner person who observes your thoughts and your feelings, that observer self. Is it your spirit? Is it your second consciousness? Is it your wise mind? Come up with whatever you like. But The overwhelming scientific evidence has demonstrated that mindfulness is a very important tool rather than a religious practice. So that will enter our tool chest, I guess you could call it, because Smart Recovery offers a 4-point program, which is on the back of your program, and it offers about 10 tools for getting sober and staying there. What's Smart Recovery? Well, first of all, as I mentioned, it's a not-for-profit 501c3. It's a network of meetings, face-to-face and online, provided by volunteers, usually trained. Lately, we've changed over to insisting that everyone who facilitates has to go through 8 weeks of online training. You got to read, you got to pass the quizzes, you got to pass the final test. You get to go online with some of the more experienced facilitators and have mock meetings online where you role play meetings where some of the people are going to bring up some of the problems that occur in meetings, like somebody wants to spend the meeting talking about AA, or somebody wants to talk about their religious experience, or somebody wants to not be quiet, one of my problems. And so they learn how to assertively keep time, make sure everybody gets a chance to speak, keep the conversation on recovery and not wherever else it could go. And the program is offered through meetings and other venues by the organization, including its wonderful website. So there's a 4-point program to Smart Recovery on the back of your enhancing and maintaining motivation to abstain. Oh, by the way, it's an abstinence organization. Similar to AA, their approach is that the best way to deal with addictions, if you're really addicted to something, if you're addicted, by the way, to eating bad food, then stop eating the bad food and eat the good food. There's some things that you really can't abstain from entirely. We're not going to abstain from eating. We're going to abstain from eating cake or huge amounts of it. Okay, so we deal with addictions that that you can't abstain from, but we also have those that you can. You can live without alcohol. You can live without cigarettes. You can live without all of the other drugs that are offered. Or maybe your doctor prescribes them and you could use them as prescribed, because some people do need morphine. Some people do need Adderall. I prefer not to get people onto that, but you know, I'm not a psychiatrist, I'm a psychologist. I don't prescribe. I do suggest various ways of dealing with stuff, but onward. So enhancing and maintaining motivation. How do we do it? We ask people to list all of their values, what's most important in your life, and we ask them, now where does the alcohol or the drugs fit in? Oh, it doesn't. That's sort of a wake-up call. Or we ask people, what do you like about using? What's the downside? What's the upside of quitting? What's the downside? We ask them to go through a cost-benefit analysis rather than a moral inventory. We ask them what they like and not don't like about using and not using. Guess what? And then we don't tell them, we ask them, so what do you make of that? Now that point, most of my clients will say, gosh, it looks like I really should do something about this, or it looks like I have a problem, or it looks like I have to stop using. Okay, that's a hell of a nice way to get there. It sure beats saying, well, my mom tells me you got drunk again last night. You're an alcoholic. You need to change. Because you know what happens when you confront people. When you push, people push back. We've known since the 50s, we've called this resistance. Now they call it denial. It's part of being an addict that you're in denial. No, it's not. Most denial is caused by really bad professional interventions based on confrontation. You tell the if you confront the person, they resist, they deny. If you ask the person, if you use questions, open-ended questions, you can elicit motivation. So one of the scientific bases for our motivational aspect is something called motivational interviewing, which I won't go over in our 20 minutes. Another is coping with urges and cravings. One technique is to learn to surf the urge. Urges come and urges go, and if you don't act on them, so many of our feelings and emotions, they come, they go, they change like the weather. And let's face it, sometimes weather doesn't change as fast as we'd like it to, but eventually the snow will stop. Eventually the urge will pass. Interestingly, any behaviorist will tell you that anything that you reward or reinforce will become stronger. So if you give in to an urge, you've made the urge more likely to occur and occur more strongly. Every time you let the urge come and go, surf it. It becomes weaker. So we teach urge surfing and some distraction techniques. The best is acceptance. Here's where the mindfulness comes in again. Learning to just accept discomfort. Anybody have a family where there's never been discomfort, where there's never been suffering? Because I understand that according to the Buddha, if I find the person whose family has never been had suffering, he said he could bring my dead child back to life. That was one of those old Buddhist stories. Just find me a mustard seed from a family that's never experienced suffering. Well, radically accepting discomfort, even extreme discomfort, even withdrawal, is very helpful. The third point, we don't have steps, we have points, is learning to manage our thoughts, feelings, and behavior, because life is more than drinking and not drinking, using and not using. Life has a lot to do with dealing with our depression, our anxiety, our anger, which, as I pointed out before, is a result of our belief system. So cognitive behavioral, or the old grandfather of CBT, rational emotive behavior therapy, is included as a way of dealing with urges. What is it I believe about this urge? It's never going to stop and I can't stand it. Really? Let's dispute that, or let's at least take a look at it and see if I can notice that. I stopped disputing. I used to listen to Albert Ellis, who has a very high adenoidal voice, and he would say, "So, you're telling yourself that you absolutely can't stand." And people would smile, and they got better in his care. And nobody could figure out why he was such a successful therapist, because he kept telling people, people would come to him and say, "I disputed my..." It used to call them irrational beliefs, but then Mr. Spock came along and the meaning of rational became emotionless. So then he said, well, unhelpful beliefs. He'd tell the person dispute, you know, "Why the hell must you be comfortable? Where is it written? What law of the universe says that you must never suffer discomfort?" And he'd say you needed to dispute with like that. And if you said, "Well, I disputed it, I see rationally why that's stupid, but I still feel discomfort," he'd say, "You need to go home and dispute your beliefs, this irrational belief, this unhelpful belief, more vigorously. Go home and shout your disputations into the mirror." Well, I heard him say this when I worked with him in 1990-91, before I came back to Madison and started the local, what became Smart Recovery Groups. It didn't work, so I'm now working through something called acceptance and commitment therapy, which, if you do go to our website next Sunday at, I think, 5 Central Time, there'll be a presentation by a friend of mine who's always mistaken for me, Hank Robb. Yeah, we're both short, bald, white men with beards. And I do my Albert Ellis imitation, and everybody goes up to him and says, "Boy, that was really great." But Hank is going to be doing a podcast, and you can catch it live and ask your questions about how acceptance and commitment therapy is going to be eventually integrated into Smart Recovery. I said it was a science-based program, and science changes. AA is never going to change, because you don't go back to the scriptures and rewrite them. You can retranslate them, but you know, and you can reinterpret them, but the words aren't going to change. We changed. My wonderful second edition has been replaced by a third edition of the Smart Recovery Handbook, and I'm sure the fourth will have more mindfulness stuff in it. So, they're still disputing, but I say, just notice that urge. Notice it and let it pass. Don't get involved with fighting with it. You'll only make it worse. Just let it sit there, and it will pass like a cloud in the sky when it's good and ready. And getting a balance of momentary and enduring satisfactions. You need a life that's meaningful and purposeful to, like I said, you got to be in Rat Park, not in solitary confinement, to not want to use drugs. So our methods include science, which hopefully evolves, meeting facilitators, receiving online training, facilitators abiding by a code of ethics. You may have read in the newspaper about some AA groups where predators have been lurking and even become, what do they call them? You got to get a, what's the word for the wonderful AA person who you go to who's going to be your
sponsor?
Thank you. I don't watch enough television to remember what they call. Yeah, so even sponsors sometimes take advantage of their people. They don't have an ethics. I mean, they should. They know what's right and wrong. We lay it out in our training, and we have individuals who have gained independence from addictive behavior, are invited to stay involved, to enhance their gains, to help others as volunteers. Most choose to graduate. In AA, in the 12-step programs, the 12th step is to keep coming back, keep selling it, keep bringing more people. You can't leave. If you leave, you're going to relapse. Our thing is, if you stop using for a good time and you're in a stable recovery, you can graduate. You don't have to keep coming to SMART meetings unless you want to. It's probably good if you come once in a while to keep it top of mind. It would be wonderful if you'd become a volunteer. Now, I didn't have a problem myself with drugs or alcohol, but lots of our volunteers, not most, but some, are lay people who were interested in it because somebody in their family had a problem, like me, or psychologists, social workers, counselors who were in the business and wanted to do something with their education to help people, to do something, cast their bread upon the waters and not expect anything in return. So we have lay people, professional people who do or don't have problems with alcohol becoming volunteers. Well, one of the reasons I'm here today is to encourage you to think about if there's something that you would like to do, you're saying to yourself, you know, people who volunteer their time are less, it's proven, they're less depressed, they're less anxious, they're emotionally healthier. I mean, eating well, exercising, getting out in nature, having a support group, a social group network and all that. Those are all things that help people. Those are lifestyle changes, but so is being a volunteer. So if anybody's interested in volunteering to become a facilitator, we're down to two. We were up to seven groups, and we're down to two groups right now because one person died, one person got a job, one person left town, and you know, the number of facilitators in Madison goes up and down. Chicago is much more, you know, big cities have more facilitators, more meetings. We now have two. So there's my pitch. We say discover the power of choice. That's our motto. We advocate choice and recovery. We inform people about all the options, not just ours, LifeRing, SOS, which stands for Save Our Sobriety or something like that. Women for Sobriety. The other two, by the way, LifeRing and SOS are, they're not necessarily science-based, but they, as a matter of fact, I sometimes think of them as AA with somebody crossing the word God out from all of the places in the 12 steps. But they are strictly atheist, strictly secular. Women for Sobriety has a spiritual element, but no appealing to an interventionist deity. So there are other ways, and as I said, there's also Moderation Management, which I've helped try to get going, and that's a moderation group. You succeed if you stop, or you succeed if you moderate, but they have a 9-step program for moderating, and that's science-based and secular. So we're not the only one, but we think people should have choices. We support the freedom to choose amongst them. We have these tools and techniques like the change plan worksheet, I just mentioned the course benefit analysis, the ABCs of rational emotive behavior therapy. What is it I believe? How do my beliefs, can I change my belief? We're going to update that. We have something, destructive imagery and self-talk awareness and refusal method. Yeah, when you realize that you're having an urge to use, when that little voice in your head, that little addictive voice in your head is saying something stupid, and we all hear that little something, come on, this time it'll be different. You can get away with it. And you'll be sober by the time she gets home or he gets home. Or, well, I can name about 50 different ones. But when you hear them, you recognize them as destructive, and you click into using the techniques that we've learned, brainstorming. You know, people come to meetings. I'm going to a party next week, and there's going to be serving alcohol, and I don't know how to handle it. How do other people handle it? Well, some of us decide not to go. Some of us decide to bring somebody along. Some of us decide that if we're okay, we stay. If we feel threatened, we go. But, oh, and how do I tell people that I'm not drinking? Well, who asked you is usually my first response. Who's asking you why you're not drinking? And if they do ask, you can tell them that you're cutting back on you're not drinking for your health. You don't have to tell them that you're a raving maniac when you're drunk who's beating up your children. You don't have to tell them all the horror of your life. They're just asking why you're not drinking. I'm not drinking because I don't wanna. Is that a good enough reason? Yes, it's a perfectly good reason. What are you going into? So we brainstorm such brilliance as I can come up with. We role play and rehearse various situations like going to the party or the wedding. And there's a few other tools that I can't possibly get to. And how do people participate? Well, they can attend the face-to-face or online meetings. And online we have message board, we have chat rooms, we have all sorts of other, we have all the information there. They can volunteer. Our organization is, I think I just went through all this, so let's skip it. We have meetings in Scotland, England, Canada, Sweden, Denmark, China, New Zealand, Uzbekistan, Australia, Iran. Yes, there's a group in Iran. There's a group actually in Beijing now. And and I went to Vietnam to look at Smart Vietnam, where they're helping people to quit heroin, which is a little bit too available. And they wanted something that wasn't religious because it's a communist government. And, you know, they're politically atheists. Though they have every religion in the world represented, and they treat them very nicely, a little bit nicer than here, because nobody claims in Vietnam that this is a Buddhist country or this is a Catholic country, though those are big represent. But let me not go there. Online self-help meetings. There's total anonymity, and you know, we have two meetings in Madison, but if you can't make those meetings and you have a computer, you can go to a meeting every day. And I've met many, many people, especially the facilitators online, who got sober by going to those meetings, and they were great. And we have message boards in the cafe. I love our website. It's on your handout. It's on my handout. smartrecovery.org. And if you want to know when the meetings are in Madison, go to madisonsmartrecovery.org, of course. And we have our handbook in all those languages. We have a teen handbook. We have a family and friends handbook. Oh, we got the training manuals. And now we have, and I got it too low, various training CDs. Where's my family and friends? Oh, gosh, that's me. See? Steinberg, editor.
Yay.
And if anybody wants to make a huge donation, I'll sign a copy and give it to you.
Yeah.
Let's see. We have a new quarterly newsletter. We have all sorts of wonderful stuff. It's based on what works. It provides diversity. It's approved by all of these wonderful organizations. They got a bunch of experts together and discussed what, you know, a good support group should have, and we meet the criteria. It's recognized by leaders in the health field and experts in addictions. So all of these, you know, American Academy of Family Physicians, Center for Healthcare and matter of fact, it's hard to read from their logos, so let's do it this way. Center for Healthcare Evaluation, National Institute of Drug Abuse, U.S. Department of, SAMHSA, and ASAM, the American Society of Addiction Medicine. They all think we're cool. So here's the contact information, but you have it in your handout. Questions? Yes. Do we have? Okay, one question, because we're running out of time.
What kind of follow-on studies have been done over time about the relative efficacy? You had mentioned, we kind of hinted at some interesting.
Oh, my favorite study is the Atkins study, where they looked at people, they measured their religiosity, and then they looked at people in AA and Women for Sobriety and SMART and I think MM, and they found just what I reported, that people, if they go to support groups, they do better than people who don't go to support groups if they go, attend, and engage, and they don't go, and if they do go, if you force them to go, they don't engage in something that doesn't share their worldview. And there's a couple of research studies that are in process right now through the VA. It's hard to study this stuff because random assignment is difficult, and if they're not hospitalized in the VA, well, a lot, you know, AA is so pervasive in our so ubiquitous that everybody ends up there somehow, even if they don't like it. And you've seen on TV every movie, every time.
Hi, my name's Henry. Hi, Henry. Yeah, I know that.
Yeah.
The trope.
You know the trope from all of the media. It's saturated. Tell me, call me, find me, and let me know if you see Smart Recovery mentioned in any detective, police, who else? Hospital, the West Wing. Yeah, they went. They had it in the basement. I mean, what damn show doesn't have somebody with an alcohol problem that doesn't go to AA? Well, that's Mike Fetch. Let's go to.
Thank you. Yeah. And I did ask Dr. Steinberger to stay after, so he'll be happy to answer more questions afterwards too, because.
Yeah.
I have questions too. But with that, I'll introduce Eric to come on up. He's got a funny little quip for us from the one, the only, Mark Twain. What was his real name?
Samuel Clemens.
Thank you.
Well, now I've got to be funny.
No, Mark Twain has to be
funny. Well, I thought the matter over. And I decided that I can do it. So I went down and bought a bicycle. An expert from the store came along home with me to instruct me, and we chose my backyard for the sake of privacy and went to work. Now, first, my instructor inquired concerning my physical strength, and I was able to inform him that I had not any. But he wanted to test my muscles, so I offered my biceps, which was my best. This made him smile. He said, "It's pulpy and soft and yielding and rounded. It evades pressure and glides from under the fingers. In the dark, you might think it was an oyster wrapped up in a rag." Perhaps he saw the hurt expression on my face, for he added briskly, "Okay, that's all right, that's all right. The bicycle will fix it. In a little while, you won't be able to tell it from a petrified kidney. So, now let's get started." Well, mine was not a full-grown bicycle, but only a colt, and skittish like any other colt. The expert explained its points in brief. He got onto its back and rode around a little to show me how easy it was to do. He said that dismounting was perhaps the hardest thing to learn, and so we would leave that to the last. But there he was in error. All he needed to do was get me up on the bicycle and stand out of the way. I could dismount all by myself. Although I was wholly inexperienced, I dismounted in the best time on record. And he was on that side, propping up the machine. We all came down with a crash. He at the bottom, I next, and the machine on top. We examined the machine. It was not in the least hurt. And I realized then how admirably these things are constructed, and so we resumed. The expert got on the other side and propped up the machine this time, but I dismounted on that side. And so the result was as before. As the machine was not hurt, we resumed. And this time the expert took up a sheltered position in behind, but somehow or other we managed to land on him again. He was full of surprised admiration and said it was abnormal. The machine was all right, though, not a scratch on her. I said it was wonderful and realized that nothing could hurt this thing but dynamite. And then he limped out to position, and we resumed once more. This time, the expert took up the position of shortstop. and got a helper to prop it up from behind. We got a handsome speed going, and presently I ran over a brick and went over the top of the handlebars, head down on the expert's back, and I saw the machine fluttering in the air between me and the sun. And it was a good thing that it came down on the expert, because that broke its fall and it was not injured. 5 days later, I went to visit the expert in the hospital, and he was doing fairly well. I myself was quite sound. I attribute this to my prudence in always dismounting on something soft. Now, some people prefer a feather bed for this, but I disagree. I think that an expert is much better. Well, the expert got out at last, and this time he brought four assistants with him, and it was a good idea. These four held the machine upright while I climbed into the saddle. Then we all formed a column. They marched on either side of me while the expert pushed from behind. All hands assisted at the dismount. Now, it is true that I could have learned without a teacher, but this would have been risky because of my natural clumsiness. The self-taught man seldom knows anything accurately, and he does not know a tenth as much as he could have known had he worked with teachers. And besides, he brags, and so fools other thoughtless people into imitating him. There are those who imagine that the lucky accidents in life's experiences are in some way useful to us. I wish I could find out how. I never knew one of them to happen twice. They always change and swap around and catch you on the inexperienced side. But I wander from the point. Get a teacher. It saves much time. Well, my instruction being complete, the expert left me, and I ventured out on my own to seek adventures. Well, you really don't have to seek adventures. That's just a phrase. They come to you. I chose a quiet Sunday along a back street, which was about 30 yards wide between the curbstones. I knew it wasn't wide enough. Still, I thought that by paying strict attention and wasting no space, I might manage to crowd through. Now, I had no sympathetic instructor saying, "Good, good, you're doing well, good, don't hurry, there, brace up, you're doing all right." But I did have a boy who was perched on a gatepost munching on a hunk of maple sugar. And he was full of interesting and useful commentary. The first time I failed and went down, he said that if it was him, he would have dressed up in pillows. That's what he would have done. The next time I went down, he advised me to learn to ride a tricycle first. And the third time I collapsed, he said he didn't believe that I could stay on a horse cart. But the next time I succeeded and got under the way in a clumsy fashion, weaving and tottering uncertainly and pretty much occupying all of the street. Oh, my slow and lumbering gait filled the boy to the chin with scorn, and he sang out, "My, but don't he rip along." Then he got down from his post and loafed along the sidewalk, still occasionally commenting, and presently he dropped into my wake and followed along from behind. A little girl passed and giggled, and she seemed about to make a remark, but the boy said, "Let him alone. He's going to a funeral." I had been familiar with that street for years and had always supposed that it was dead level, but it was not, as the bicycle now informed me to my surprise. It notices any rise or fall where you never knew the one existed. I was toiling up a slight rise that made me tug and pant and perspire, and still, labor as I might, the machine came almost to a standstill every now and then. At times like this, the boy would say, "There, take it easy, take a rest, there ain't no hurry. They can't hold the funeral without you." Well, I was at the end of my ride, and it was necessary for me to turn around. And this is not a pleasant thing when you undertake it for the first time on your own responsibility, and neither is it likely to succeed. But after a time or two, I started on the return trip. And it was then that I saw a farmer's wagon headed towards me loaded with cabbages. And if there is anything to perfect the precariousness of my steering, it was just that. The farmer was occupying the middle of the road with his wagon, leaving barely 14 or 15 yards to the side. I couldn't shout at him. If a beginner opens his mouth, he is gone. But in this grisly emergency, the boy came to my rescue, and for once I had to be grateful to him, for he kept a close watch on me as I wobbled and shouted to the farmer accordingly, to the left, or this jackass will run you over. The man started to, and then I wobbled. No, to the right. I wobbled again. Hold on, that won't do. To the left. No, to the right. To the left. Right. Left. Oh, stay where you are or you're a goner. And just then, I hit the wagon in the middle and went down with a pile. Hang it, I said. Couldn't you see I was coming? And the farmer looked down at me from his perch, and he said, yes, I could see you was coming, but I couldn't tell which way you was coming. Nobody could now, could they? You couldn't yourself now, could you? So what was I to do? Well, there was something to that, and so I was gracious to him in return. I said that I was no doubt just as much to blame as he was. And within the next 5 days, I achieved so much progress that the boy couldn't keep up with me. He had to go back to his gatepost and content himself with watching me fall at long distance. Now, I must say that the falls I suffered in the boulevard were not nearly as bad as those which I got from dogs. Well, I've heard it say that no expert is quick enough to run over a dog, that a dog is always able to skip out the way. I think this might be true. But I think that the reason he couldn't run over a dog is because he was trying to do it. I didn't try to run over any dog, but I ran over every dog that came along. I think it makes a great deal of difference. If you try to run over a dog, he knows how to calculate. But if you try to miss him, he does not know what to do, and is liable to jump in the wrong way every time. Even when I couldn't hit a wagon anymore, I could still hit a dog. And they all enjoyed seeing me practice. They came from all over the neighborhood, for there was very little in our neighborhood to entertain a dog. It took me time to learn how to miss a dog, but eventually I did even that. And I can steer as well as I want to now. And I'll catch that boy one of these days and run him over if he does not reform. So in conclusion, I say to you, get yourself a bicycle. Get a bicycle. You will not regret it if you live.
So then thoughts. My thoughts today are that, you know, AA is a good thing for people who need help. It's a good place and it's a good option for people. We were knocking on AA for a while, but I want to also acknowledge all the good that AA does. It also is a really strong organization that at least is really good at being a strong organization, so people have something to go to. Even, you know, in not so urban, not so populated places. So, you know, I read a fictional novel once where the character had a horrible addiction problem, and he went to these AA meetings, and he's just, I don't understand why it works, but it's saving my life. And so I think, you know, having options is the biggest thing. For people where AA works, good, I'm glad it's there. For people where AA doesn't work, I'm glad Smart Recovery is there, you know, for people where church works, I'm glad they have church to go to. And for people where church doesn't work, I'm glad that there are now other options for them to go to. And I think for the most part, all of these things are trying to do good. And so I think celebrating that, celebrating all those organizations out there that help people improve themselves, help people empower themselves, and all the options that we are getting out there, all good things. So those are my thoughts for today. There's coffee, there's tea, there's cookies that if you don't eat, I get to take home, so skip those.
And talking to...
Yep.
There you go.
And then February 22nd will be our next service.
Thanks for coming.